On the evening of November 12, 2025, the Hager Auditorium at the Museum of the Rockies was filled to capacity with people who had come to hear the Bozeman Library Friends and Foundation's 10th symposium entitled, The Future of Intelligence, Are We Ready for AGI? The Foundation's Executive Director, Janae Johnson, introduced the speakers, Sarah Myers-West, co-director of AI Now, John Shepard, distinguished professor of computer science at Montana State University, and Charlie Warzel, staff writer at The Atlantic, as well as the panel's moderator, Tim Locke, founder of The Human Stack. We regret that the beginning seconds of Janae Johnson's introduction were cut off due to technical issues, but we're glad that they were resolved quickly, and we hear her now.
Symposium was created to encourage civil, thoughtful discourse around complex topics. We do this by bringing together a panel of subject matter experts for a moderated conversation with you, our audience. And tonight's program is being recorded by KGVM Community Radio, and it will be available in a couple of weeks on their website. So if you want to listen to it again or if you want to share it with friends, you can find it there. So tonight's discussion explores what may be the most transformational technology of our lifetime, artificial intelligence. In many ways, we're still at the frontier of this revolution. AI systems are becoming sophisticated enough that it's sometimes difficult to tell what's been created by a human from what's been generated by a machine. AI holds incredible promise. It can boost productivity, accelerate discovery, and drive innovation across nearly every field. But it also raises profound ethical, social, and even existential questions about our future. Tonight, our panelists will help us navigate this evolving landscape, sharing their insights into how artificial intelligence may shape the world ahead. So our first speaker tonight is Sarah Myers-West. Sarah co-directs the AI Now Institute, focusing on how market incentives and infrastructures shape technology's role in society. Her forthcoming book, Tracing Code, examines the origins of data capitalism and commercial surveillance. She has advised Congress, the White House, and international regulatory agencies, and has testified before Congress on AI, competition, and data privacy. Dr. John Shepard is a distinguished professor of computer science at Montana State University. He was elected an IEEE Fellow in 2007 for contributions to system-level diagnosis and prognosis. His research includes probabilistic graphical models, deep learning, and applications in system testing, healthcare, agriculture, and wildlife management. Charlie Warzel writes the Galaxy Brain newsletter for The Atlantic magazine, where he's a contributing writer. Previously, he was a writer-at-large for the New York Times opinion section and a senior technology writer at BuzzFeed News. Charlie is the author of the book Out of Office, The Big Problem, and Bigger Promise of Working from Home. And moderating tonight's discussion is our hometown boy, Tim Locke. Tim is a nonprofit AI strategist and founder of The Human Stack, where he helps organizations approach artificial intelligence in ethical and human-centered ways. He created the Upskillerator, a learning community for nonprofit professionals to grow their AI skills, and he hosts the weekly AI for Anyone live show. So please give a welcome to our speakers.
Thank you all for coming out. It's really great to see such turnout. I was thinking about what AI means, and it stands for artificial intelligence. And I'm telling you that because a few years ago, I was in Phoenix to speak at a conference, and I was visiting my mom and dad. My mom and dad live here in Bozeman. They have since the 60s, but they got smart, and they fly to Phoenix in the winter. So I was down there talking with my dad, and he asked what I was in town for, and I said, I'm talking about AI. And I said, do you know what it is? And he was like, yeah. So we started to have a conversation about AI, and it got weird. Which happens a lot with me, but this time it wasn't my fault. So we kept talking. I finally said, hey, Dad, what do you think AI means? And he's from Miles City, grew up on a ranch. So you all know where this is headed. He said, artificial insemination. And I said, oh, well, that might be what it used to mean, but it doesn't mean that anymore. So if any of you are here to hear about that form of AI, that's not the discussion. I just want to be clear about that. It's actually a good point because there's a lot of disagreement about what AI actually does mean. And so, John, I wanted to start with you and just get at a foundational question. What is AI? What is AGI? Should we be worried about extinction? And what makes this technology fundamentally different from other technology waves?
Thank you, Tim, for the easy question. Not so much. As you pointed out, AI as a field or as a concept, frankly, is not very well defined. And it really comes from different perspectives. I think in some respects, one of the original views was trying to build a computer-based system that largely simulated the way humans reason. But even that's loaded, because what do we mean by reason? And one of the things I often ask my students when I ask them to try to define AI, and they come back with things like that, is that, why do you want to build something so stupid? So it really is something that we continue to wrestle with. And as a computer scientist, one of the other definitions that often comes up, it's a fairly old definition, but not one that's widely recognized, and I'm going to use a technical term and then I'll try to explain it, is that AI is solving NP-complete problems. And what that means is solving computationally hard problems. And if you can do that, then you can actually start solving problems that give the impression of being only solvable by humans. Now, when we start talking about artificial general intelligence, the picture changes a bit, because that notion of humanity becomes absolutely critical, because it's really reaching to the point where the human and the machine become indistinguishable. And it is more than just a matter of, can we communicate reasonably well with this thing? Can it actually carry out tasks, accomplish things at a human level? It goes well beyond what ChatGPT is, for example. And so when we start talking about the implications of that, you know, Janae said during the introduction that we're very much at the frontier here. It's still quite new, and we're going to get to this later, but when we start talking about AGI specifically, we're a long way away.
Sarah, you're up next. Now, we'd just love to hear, what does AI mean in your world, and what is the one thing people need to understand about it, how it intersects with your work?
Yeah, I mean, I guess to sort of build a little bit on what John's already offered us. I mean, as he's pointed to, AI's meant lots of different things over the course of an almost 70-year history. There've been many different sort of approaches to building AI. If this were the 1980s, we'd be talking about expert systems or systems that are trying to use symbolic logic to replicate the way that we think. By and large, the systems that we're talking about today are built using a few different components. Very, very large data sets that are often either produced by scraping information from the web, or it's data that's been collected by often commercial firms using sort of surveillance techniques. You also have to have huge amounts of computational infrastructure to process that much data. And there's also often a human layer that, you know, the data needs to be labeled, or there are processes of reinforcement learning with human feedback, sort of teaching and what's otherwise like sort of a fundamentally statistical-based system how to, you know, associate probabilities, things that like look a little bit more like a human might have, you know, produced them. That those sort of like fundamental pieces apply both in, you know, the forms of AI that have been largely used over the last couple of decades, things like deep learning, neural networks, but also true of generative AI. What's different with generative AI is that those techniques are used to try and predict patterns in human text or in images to try and guess, you know, what's like the next thing that replicates what a human would otherwise do. It's not for nothing that this trajectory of AI, which has kind of become the dominant current, but again, is not the only way of building AI, sort of builds on the resources that, you know, the tech firms that have kind of dominated the industry all had. The Googles, the Amazons, the Microsofts, they had these big data sets, they had the computational infrastructure. And so I think part of what sort of set us on this trajectory is the incentive structures of those firms, trying to sort of perpetuate a business model that has generated an awful lot of profit up until now, and trying to sort of move them, their sort of dominant position, into that next phase.
Thank you. And Charlie, same question to you. What does AI mean in your world, and what's the one thing people need to understand about how it intersects with your work?
I'm the dilettante here, the journalist person. I've been covering technology for the past 17 or so years, which kind of coincides with the rise of the social web, the web 2, you know, the platforms, the companies that are now the tech giants. And a lot of that work has been sort of grappling with the externalities of what they've achieved, right? This notion that these companies set out to, if you're Google, organize the world's information, if you're Facebook, connect the world, right? And largely succeeded in those missions, but didn't necessarily bring about a utopia, but have brought about a lot of kind of chaos and also some, you know, obviously some very, very useful technology and tools, and powerful technology and tools, and a whole lot of advertising revenue. And so the artificial intelligence boom, let's call it, November 30th will be 3 years to the day that ChatGPT launched. And in that short amount of time, I think it's really kind of rewired culture, right? I wouldn't say it was necessarily rewired our society in the ways that they would claim, but, you know, most people have seen a chatbot. You've certainly interacted with the outputs of a chatbot somewhere. There's obviously a lot of concern around the future, around things like job loss, around the ways that this is, you know, potentially going to remake our society, or that people will buy into it. And so there is, we're sort of facing down the barrel of, are we going to experience these externalities that we felt, you know, with Mark Zuckerberg's tool that he made to rate the hotness of women in the dorms, and, you know, now we have all these other side effects. Are we going to experience those types of things, and what are they? What are they going to be, right? There's a lot of anxiety, and I think I write a lot about the cultural impacts of these technologies, try to understand them. And I think what a lot of people feel right now is that AI is a technology that primarily, its primary output is to sort of drive people insane. And I mean that in a lot of different ways. I mean that in the sense of there are people who are having mental health episodes potentially with the technology because of, you know, what they perceive it to be. There are people who believe it to be extremely dangerous, civilizationally dangerous. And there are people who think that it's hardly anything different than autocomplete on your phone, right? And the conversation is extremely polarized. There's a lot of fear, there's a lot of investment, there's a lot of FOMO, there's a lot of whatever, right? And so for me, I don't have as much of a technical understanding, but I see this as something that we're all basically being told we have to deal with, because it's being put upon us, and we have to figure out the ways to live with it and around it. And so that's sort of my, I'm trying to chronicle the AI delusions, many of which there are.
And I think that I feel like it's actually important to note that ChatGPT came along and made it famous 3 years ago, right? That's kind of what happened. So by show of hands, how many of us in the last week have used either ChatGPT or Gemini or an AI like that in the last week? Hands up. Okay, right. And I think it's worth just noting, we're not here having a conversation about Excel, right? We're not here talking about Chrome or something else, or Salesforce or some CRM. And I know that because for years I've been trying to get people interested in these systems. And ChatGPT did in 5 days, right? It hit 1 million users in 5 days. That's the fastest technology to hit a million users that's ever come along. And so I do think that there is something different about this technology, and I think that we are all in this world now trying to figure out what does it mean, what is it, And so I think that, I appreciate your perspectives on that. The next area that I want to talk about is the investment in regulation. So there's an unprecedented amount of investment flowing into AI. So Charlie and Sarah, what does this level of investment tell us? And do you think we will see regulatory or political reactions to it?
I'll start. So I screwed this up on a radio show a while back, so I'm going to read off some of the stats because of the egg on my face situation. So far, there's been $375 billion in global spending in artificial intelligence. As of the middle of 2025, three quarters of the S&P 500 gains since ChatGPT launched have come from AI-related stocks. NVIDIA, which makes some of the GPUs that power this, all of this, is worth $5 trillion, right? That's 94 times Ford's market cap. AI expenditure is 92% of GDP growth in the first half of 2025.
Can you say that again, that last one?
AI expenditure accounts for 92% of GDP growth in the first half of 2025. And so the conversation, that's really like the big figure there that leads people to start to, and there's a conversation around this that's happening in a lot of different spheres and in the media sphere around this idea of, like, is there an AI investment bubble, right? Because not only is there this you know, massive amount of investment in the technology, but there's also the way in which the money is flowing, right? There's concerns. There's a lot of charts maybe you've seen on social media that show the money moving in kind of a circle, which is a chart design thing. But also a lot of these companies are investing in each other. Right, and then the money's going back, and it's not necessarily clear exactly, you know, how much or where always. And it's not to say that it's nefarious, but it is. It's a lot, right? And again, I say it's not to say it's nefarious because I'm a journalist, I'm trying not to get sued or anything. It's fascinating, and a lot of this is off of the backs of data centers, right? Data centers are sort of the thing that powers a lot of these models, the technology in general, and being kind of vague, but these data centers are real pieces of physical infrastructure. They're very large. They consume quite a bit of electricity. They let, you know, off emissions. They don't actually produce a ton of jobs outside of the construction of them. They're very expensive. It's not quite clear how often the technology inside of them needs to be, you know, replenished and how, you know, how often it becomes obsolete. And the data center spend the money is going into these data centers off the idea that the more they can scale up, the more powerful these models can be, the more powerful the models can be, the closer we can come to some kind of better intelligence or super intelligence or something like that. And so what you have is a lot, like historic levels, like genuinely historic, like the highway infrastructure in the United States, like that level of investment in just the past year or so into this technology on the promise that it is going to fulfill some kind of, you know, destiny. And it's not necessarily clear at this moment that these tools are going to be able to do the things that a lot of the founders say that they're going to do. They are useful now, but they, you know, as you said, AGI may be a long ways away, if at all. And so so this is the concern, right? This idea that there is this massive, massive investment that a lot of the economy right now, a lot of the growth in the economy is hinging on this one thing. And the investment better pay off, and it's not certain that that would be the case.
Yeah, I mean, I think that story about what AGI is going to deliver is doing a lot of work right now. That there's sort of the idea that, and this is something that some tech CEOs have said pretty explicitly, like Eric Schmidt saying, we don't have to worry too much about climate change because AGI is going to solve that for us. Or we don't have to worry about, you know, curing cancer because AGI is going to solve that for us. It's like there's sort of been a move to really focus in on one singular bet and to defund other areas. You know, we're seeing the defunding of the NIH, the defunding of National Science Foundation funding in the name of sort of going all in on AI. I think the undercover dimension to this is that a lot of this investment is being de-risked in a pretty significant way by the federal government, by governments outside of the U.S. as well, where sort of AI has sort of been designated as this like really strategically significant sector, important for economic security, for national security, again, without sort of like clear substantiation of what the end game is going to be. But, you know, in a series of executive orders, we've seen sort of the winding back of like permitting in order to speed the pace at which data centers are being put forward, sort of a broad push sort of to roll back any sort of regulatory scrutiny of the companies that are building AI firms. This summer, there was sort of a big dust up over a potential moratorium where states were going to be like banned from enforcing laws on AI for a full decade. That Congress voted 99-1 to shoot that one down, but there's like a different version that came forward in the AI action plan. And I think maybe most significantly too, there's an executive order that says that the U.S. government is going to get into the business of kind of trying to create markets abroad for AI products through a variety of different mechanisms, trying to, you know, ensure that the, you know, AI, US-made AI is being sold to other countries. So it's a pretty sort of muscular industrial policy that's taking shape to kind of, you know, really double down on this bet on AI, and I think it's just particularly worrisome given that we just aren't seeing like the clear use cases that would justify the kind of projections that we're seeing from the industry.
Are you saying the rollbacks on funding to other areas are directly related to increases in funding for AI?
They're not. They're sort of happening in the same time scale, but not. Uh-huh. They're not saying like in the name of, you know, doubling down on AI. But that is, you know, functionally what is happening.
Interesting. Thanks. That is a fresh take that I not heard, and I think that's important to note. So, John, from your technical standpoint, is there a gap between investment promises and the technical realities on what that tech can deliver?
You don't like yes, no questions. Yes.
Good night.
Good night, right. And actually, I think this even connects back a little bit to what Sarah is saying. A little bit of history. When you go back to the early days of AI, and by the way, that's not 3 years ago. The early
what
days
is the early days of AI?
The 1950s. And actually, you could argue that it predates that, but it was at something called the Dartmouth Conference that the term artificial intelligence was coined. Actually, it was the proposal to fund the Dartmouth Conference where that name was coined. And so it's an old, I mean, we're talking about 70 plus years. And what happened through those years, and especially when we move into the 60s and the 70s, was a lot of promise. People claiming that we were going to be able to build highly intelligent, highly functional systems, and yet they didn't deliver. And what happened toward the end of the 70s was we entered a period called the AI winter, where money was withheld, government funding, other sources of funding, and any research that took place in AI went underground. And it took a number of developments for this to come back, one of which was the expert system, which is basically a system that simulates an expert in solving very specific problems. The other, with respect to neural nets, was what's called the backpropagation algorithm, which is still today the primary way that we train neural nets. And then all of a sudden, hey, we were able to solve some of these problems and actually answer and deliver on the promises being made, and the funding came back and came back in a big way. The fear that we have now, and this goes back to the economic bubble that we're talking about, is the promises are once again being made. We're not yet seeing the delivery on those promises, at least to the extent that they're expecting. And the fear is going to be another AI winter. Because eventually the funding agencies and the corporations are going to realize that they're not getting the return on their investments. And things, it's probably not going to be as bad as in the 70s and 80s, but there is going to be a sudden drop. And that is going to end up hurting everybody. Because right now, the type of research that we're doing in AI specifically does have tremendous potential. But if we end up focusing that research in highly specific ways that aren't going to deliver, then a lot of that potential is going to go unrealized.
Sarah, I want to talk about what's powering all of this. Data centers with energy consumption and the physical infrastructure behind it. What are the social externalities and environmental costs that people aren't seeing?
Yeah, I mean, a few of them have come up already, right? A lot of the data centers that are being deployed in really like people's backyards all across the country, they're being built on the promise, you know, being able to contribute to the economic development of the communities that they're being built in. But then when the data center arrives, one, I mean, these are not places that are like teeming with human activity. Like there's, you know, often job promises, but a lot of them are related to the construction. That construction might not be, you know, creating jobs for folks who live in the community. It might be folks who are brought in from other places. And then, you know, at the end of the day, it might be like five jobs that sort of stick around over the long term. There are other kinds of costs to take into account. A lot of the biggest data center developments that are new are being powered by gas turbines. We're seeing coal plants that were scheduled to be shut down, having their lives extended in order to provide the energy that's necessary to power them. That creates all other kinds of pollution that are affecting the communities where they're being built out. Noise pollution is one, like the sort of buzzing sound in the background. That's one of the things that I think is particularly annoying for residents of Northern Virginia. In Memphis, there's a Colossus data center that was built to power Elon Musk's sort of Grok AI system. That's running on enormous gas turbines. That's led to significant increases in rates of asthma and allergies within the community. There are elders there who are like coming down with asthma for the first time in their lives. They're like 80 years old. And then the cost and reliability of electricity is another thing that has been affected by the data center build out. That, you know, ratepayers are seeing surges in the price of electricity, and that they can't count on electric supply to be as constant as it would be otherwise. So there's a number of different immediate effects of the data center build out that are affecting people.
Charlie, I want to talk about the human impact. Not just the misinformation to the information ecosystem, but especially the job loss that is happening relative to AI as well. Can you speak to that?
With job loss, it's tricky because it's so much more of a fear and a meme than it is actually something that we can really prove at the moment, right? I mean, some of the selling point of this technology from some of the biggest boosters is this idea that you have these hyper competent agents that can do these sort of menial tasks and administrative tasks and some even bigger tasks, and that they can assume the jobs of entry-level employees, right? Like an extremely competent intern that you need to keep an eye on is how a lot of people like describe this when they're evangelists for it, right? Like a real go-getter, but you gotta check its work. And there's a lot of, you know, bosses and people in positions of power who see this and see, you know, productivity gains and this notion of, you know, it's obviously a machine is less unruly as an employee and demands a little bit less and the hours are better than you know, an entry-level employee. And so there's this real fear, right? And the selling point of the technology in that sense is that these are going to be everywhere, right? They're only getting better. They're only getting more competent at doing these types of tasks. And so the expectation for people who are just out there in the world is, when is it going to take my job, right? Mm-hmm. And I think what we can see now is, like, there are, well, I don't think they're even going to release, like, the October jobs numbers this month. I think I saw that today, which is in its own right kind of mind-boggling. But there are concerns about, you know, about job loss. There are concerns about unemployment numbers going up. There are obviously, like, there are big companies that are laying off people like Amazon, et cetera, and Meta. But there's also not, like, direct proof that this is happening, right? So we're all kind of, like, shadow boxing this idea of, are these layoffs because machines are taking these jobs? And I think it's most acute here. I mean, everyone can feel this, but it's most acute with people who are entering the workforce or who are very young. A common thing I hear from people in Gen Z is this notion of, like, if not actually feeling that kind of hurt, it's this real fear of graduating into a job market where, like, do people need me for these jobs? And if they don't need me for these jobs, how do I get in on the ground floor of whatnot, right? And this notion of extra precarity. So I think we don't really know yet. I think, like, it's still extremely early days for this. And again, the promise of the technology is not necessarily hitting some of these things. I may get this wrong, but I think it was Salesforce that, you know, had laid off a number of people to replace the jobs with AI and has since hired back some of that workforce because they realized it wasn't working out as they thought. There's a few examples of that elsewhere. So I think we're in the early days. But there is that fear, right? And so to the other part of your question, the misinformation, I think that is just very clearly, like, we are playing with some real fire there. I think just in terms of giving every single person in the world the ability to create movie quality videos of anything based off text prompts that render in high definition, and where people can license their faces out. You know, I don't think anyone looks at the information environment right now and says, we're good. Let's add this chaos in and see what, you know. So that's really concerning. But I also think, too, that there is just this, these tools are really great for propaganda. Like, I think a lot of the misinformation stuff, having covered it for a decade now, people are pretty smart in terms of just being duped by, like, absolute, like, fakery, right? Like, the idea that Donald Trump's being dragged to jail, you know? Like, people can realize that that didn't happen or something like that. But it's this stuff on the margins, right? This idea of, like, plausible deniability or the creation of propaganda. And what we're seeing there is that these tools are perfect for that. They're perfect at illustrating a reality the way that you want to see it. So I think a place where that's been most concerning for me as an observer and reporter is just the number of people who are creating fake, like, videos of immigrants, you know, like, robbing stores or doing whatever, or fake videos of ICE agents, you know, enforcing this to scare people, to keep them inside their homes, or to make people believe that their cities are war zones, things like that. That's just so easy and so cheap, and the ability for that propaganda to inflame real tensions that already exist in the country, I think, is just, it's dangerous and it's reckless, and we have decided to, you know, shoot first, ask questions later with this, and that part of it, I think, is, that's, like, to me, a lot of the harms of AI are sort of, like, some of them are theoretical. That this feels like it's a harm that's being propagated right now.
I want to go back to the question about jobs for a second. I don't intend this to be a an attempt to refute what was said, because that's it isn't. But as sort of a bellwether, one of the things that is interesting is when we look at the incoming students in computer science. And you would think that with the boom that we're seeing with AI, that more and more people would want to go into computer science in order to study this phenomenon and actually build these systems. And up until recent years, the enrollments in computer science have indeed been growing and growing and growing. This year, we experienced a huge drop. In fact, our enrollments are about half. And a lot of it is because of the fear of not having jobs when they graduate. A lot of it is coming from the parents who are advising the students, don't go into this risky field because there may be no jobs. And we are seeing a little bit of that when we start looking at programmers and software engineers in the industry, especially the junior level positions and even now mid-level positions. And so I see that as a potential bellwether for this larger problem, where if people are not even going to go into the field, we're not even going to be able to maintain the systems that are being built now.
I wanted to ask you that, and also to take that one step further and say, what are the ethical concerns about bias and other landmines in how the systems themselves work?
And that's a great question. And something that is fortunately getting a lot of attention these days when we start looking at how these systems are being built and how they're being trained. And I think we have to remember that a lot of the tools that we're talking about, whether it be ChatGPT or Gemini or Copilot or whatever, underlying them are models that have been trained on data. And so I made the comment earlier that one of the most common ways of getting that data is by scraping the data sources that are out there. What that means is the data is unvetted. And because it's unvetted, it's biased. And that, when we start talking about things like hallucination, a lot of the source of the hallucination is because of the bias in the data. And that is then going to lead to larger problems when we start making decisions based on recommendations coming from these tools, when those recommendations themselves are inherently biased. And so if we're going to see any kind of a correction there largely has to be a second look at how we build the tools in the first place. And going back to the foundation, going back to the data sources and vetting that data in order to avoid the data, the bias in the first place.
Thank you for that. Sarah, I want to give you this last question before we move to audience questions here. I just want to ask about your work inside the FTC and the challenge that corporate power and concentration has in AI. When you look at the government and regulatory bodies, what are you seeing as thoughtful institutional responses versus reactions to AI?
Easy question.
That's what I'm here for.
So, I mean, I think that the biggest challenge that we're facing right now is that, again, like, we can't treat anything about this as this industry or this technology as inevitable. Like, there's a huge amount of scope to, you know, change the trajectory that we're on. It's hard because a lot of the companies that are driving forward, you know, this moment that we're in, have become, you know, so giant, so like the amount of economic power that they wield is so big that they can go to like any country that is considering enforcing its laws and just kind of flex and be like, well, we're just gonna leave. Like, I talked to your prime minister, like, we're bigger than your GDP, we're just gonna leave your market. Like, an FTC fine is just kind of like a slap on the wrist or a budget line that they can account for. So how do you, you know, meaningfully develop leverage or institutional friction that's going to change the behavior of corporations that are this big is a really challenging public policy problem. And I think what, on my more hopeful days, one of the things that I think is helpful about this moment, as I think John was alluding to earlier, like, we've had this sort of transformational moment in the way that we're all engaging with AI. For a long time, I'd go into policy discussions or I'd be going to talk to folks about AI, and it was too abstracted, you know, it was sort of too distanced from our day-to-day experiences. Our lives, our life chances, our access to resources is continually being shaped by AI systems, but frequently they're AI systems that are being used on us, not by us. But the fact that we now have this like direct connection with AI that's used by us, I think has created the scope for having a more meaningful public conversation. And it's in that like the sort of that scope for like small d democratic debate about AI that I feel more hopeful. Mm-hmm. I think we've seen a lot of really promising community level pushback against particular uses of AI, whether that's sort of deciding, no, that data center can't be built in my backyard, or I think there's now 10, probably more than that, cities now that have passed bans on the use of AI in setting rental prices because there's been this endemic problem where rents have been set by algorithmic systems that are sort of because of the way that they're being calibrated and the data that they're trained on, the business logic that they operate on. They've been keeping, you know, lots of apartments empty so that they can try and charge higher rent. Like, sort of getting at those particular uses and the ways that they're hurting people and affecting people's lives is one place where we can start to build the muscles for how to change the way that AI is being used, the way it's affecting people. And I think sort of build towards those bigger battles.
I'm going to go to questions from the audience here. We're starting with, what are the most alarming or promising AI tools in development that we should be aware of?
It's still hard to answer the ones with the most promise. And I do think there's still a great deal of promise coming from Gen AI. But I caveat that going back to where we started, where we have to look at the potential sources of bias, of deception, and so on. But still, these tools are being used to tremendous effect in a variety of contexts. And I'll give you one example that actually we were doing in my own lab, where we're working, well, we're not anymore. We finished a project that was funded by the provost, where we were trying to find ways of using AI to help new students that are coming into the university actually build a sense of purpose and belonging in order to help them succeed in the long run. And what we did was we developed a tool that used a particular large language model. It's called BERT Topic. It's a topic modeling method in order to build a social network. And then once we were able to build the social network, and we were building it based on data that we got from these incoming students in terms of answers to essay questions. And the whole idea was, can we find common themes, common interests among the students based on that text, build a social network from that, and then recommend cohorts. And then the idea is, because these people have common interests, that maybe they can provide a sense of mutual support. That is an example of something that has a lot of strong potential in terms of helping students that are trying to navigate a new environment, because frankly, a university is a scary new environment. So that's just one example, but there are others. There are lots in healthcare. I'm doing work in the area of wildfire management, not wildlife management, and also work in precision agriculture. And these are all things that have a lot of interest, especially to the economy in Montana, but not just Montana, throughout the country.
Next question, in an age defined by profit-driven ethics, what are the obligations of AI tech companies and shareholders of those companies to protect their users and manage waste output and toll on resources?
I'll come in here. I'm going to answer the question. I'm going to come in sideways. I think that what we're seeing are signs of an unhealthy economy, that the incentive structures have gotten a little bit skewed in a way that things have gotten very speculative and where sort of the dynamics of the market are leading to less competition than there should be, competition that's not really on the merits, you know, this circular financing, sort of cartel-like movements. Like, all that's kind of a signal that, like, I don't know that we should sort of just, like, leave things to just, like, the market's not going to sort of get us out of this
fix. The invisible hand might not work
this
time.
Yeah. I would love to be in a place where, like, the is sort of the meaning in the institutional friction between shareholders and companies was sufficient to like change the structure of the market. I just don't think that the scales are really tipped that way right now. And so, you know, think through like smart policy, through industrial policy, through, you know, we haven't really talked about labor, but there's been a lot of sort of movement within the labor movement to introduce new kinds of friction so that workers are also starting to set the terms on which their lives are affected and their workplaces are affected by the deployment of these tools. Those other sources of friction, I think, are really important to have in the picture, because if we're only optimizing for return on investment, we're not getting to a place where the market is operating in a healthy way.
I also think that the shareholder bit too, like instead of, as you're saying this, but like instead of being what I've seen, instead of being like a moderating force, it's driving worse things to happen. So some of these tech companies, one thing that really gives like hard 2008 vibes is some of the financing that's happening for data centers. And one of the reasons, so essentially some of these tech companies are going to like private equity companies, getting them to either raise money or put the money up for the data center. And then the tech companies are charging rent for them. And all of this is being basically securitized and put into essentially like bonds. And those bonds are being packaged as financial instruments. And they're organized into these tranches based off of risk. And those are all words that, you know, sort of bring to
that
mind.
Does give 2008.
Yeah, it gives a little 2008 vibes. That's not to say that like tech companies are not subprime lenders. You know, it's not the same thing. But it's this idea of these tech companies do not want the debt on their balance sheets because of their shareholders. And so they are going to this other way of trying to get the money. And that way of getting the money is a lot harder to trace and see what is happening. And so if there is sort of like a system that is really circular, or there is this kind of like house of cards nature to it, it's a lot harder to see. Like as much as the circular chart of investment is concerning, it also is something that like is happening somewhat in public. Whereas this, you know, this financialization is a little concerning. And that's the shareholders, and that's like the hyper growth and scale obsession.
Yeah, a lot is happening through special purpose vehicles too, which make it even harder to see.
There's also a way in which we should really be thinking about this in stakeholder rather than just shareholder. And it feels like that conversation is dying down at a moment where it's more important than ever. So I'll just add my own comments on that. Next question, with AI's ability to replicate and change, for example, substituting one actor for another, how will people differentiate true from false? Thank you. This is a great question. Charlie, I'm gonna kick that to you first.
I'm somewhat optimistic on the question of media literacy and people being able to tell true from false. I think on individual bases, lots of people are being duped all the time, right? But I do think that like, as human beings, we do develop these systems, right? Like, if you were to show somebody, you know, who didn't have access to television, like Photoshop, you know, like, they would freak out. We all get used to the technology that we have. And I'm not saying, again, I think it's causing a lot of harm right now, but I do sort of optimistic on that part of it. But what I think is really harmful is its use, again, in this nature of like of creating propaganda, of being able to illustrate your particular worldview in a way that leads us to basically, and we see it now, like live in distinct sort of versions of our own realities, bespoke realities, right? And I think that that's really difficult, because when you come down like to the nature of democracy, right, we need to establish what is true. We need to be able to have a functional debate, and we need to hold powerful people to account. Well, if we can't establish what's true from what's false, and because we all have different definitions of that, then we can't have the debate. If we can't have the debate, there's no way we can hold people and power to account, and the whole system is disordered and it starts to like break down. So I think that that what worries me more about these tools is more about the way that shameless, self-interested actors who have, you know, either a financial or political interest in continuing to divide people who have more in common than they don't. I think that that is like that's the scarier thing to me. That's the thing that I would be more and am more concerned about. I think we'll all sort of be able to understand that, like, the Pope isn't wearing an Armani, you know, right, puffer coat at the Vatican or whatever. That was a thing like 2 years ago. People thought that the Pope was wearing a fashionable coat. I think we'll figure that out. But I think it's going to be really hard when these synthetic illustrations and videos and narratives are put onto people to help them stay more entrenched and justify their beliefs.
I feel like an important thing you're saying at the end there, justifying their beliefs, is that often we approach truth from a am I right and how am I right perspective rather than a what is the truth here. And I feel like when it comes to propaganda, that makes it a lot easier. John, it looks like you were going to say something.
Yeah, I wanted to actually go back to where some of the conversation already started tonight, because to be honest, I think this question of being able to discern what's true and what's false is a question that's independent of whether we're talking about humans or AI or anything else for that matter. And what that does is it suggests an actually a more fundamental problem, especially if we start talking about this idea of AGI. Out of curiosity, how many people in the audience have seen the movie The Imitation Game? Do you know where that name comes from? So it's a movie about Alan Turing, and The Imitation Game refers to what we now refer to as the Turing test. And it was a thought experiment that Turing proposed in a paper that he wrote back in the 1950s about how do we tell if a computational artifact, if a computer, is intelligent or not. And in a nutshell, I'm not going to go through the whole definition, but basically, if you cannot distinguish the computer from a human, you can declare that the computer is intelligent. And if we think that AGI is upon us, and again, I don't, but some people, believe it or not, do, then that suggests that we are approaching a point or perhaps already at a point where we can't tell the difference between human versus a chatbot just being some AI. And, you know, one of the things that educators have to deal with frequently now is trying to detect whether or not AI was used in the production of a paper or an assignment or so on, to the point now where we're trying to come up with methods of, let's not even worry about that, let's figure out how to use these AI tools beneficially. But the underlying question is still the same. How do we tell the difference? And if we can't tell the difference, then we're just back to the original question of what's true and false, and we no longer care what the source is.
Speaking of AGI, next question is, what entity will provide guardrails for AGI? So say that we get to AGI, right, and AI, what entity could provide those guardrails? Is it Meta? Is it Musk, Google, Microsoft, Congress, EU? And outside alien forces that find us, like what?
Well, I'm going to ask a question in response, and it's admittedly a devil's advocate question. Why do we need the guardrails in the first place? If we're going to have AGI, and we assume that we can reach that point, then why can't we just impose the same standards that we impose on people and the way people behave?
If we take that same question and we apply it to AI, or if we apply the Turing test, which they keep moving the goalpost, right?
It was a thought experiment. It's not a real test.
Sure. I guess my question, maybe to you, Sarah, is as someone that spends a lot of time looking at these regulatory bodies, which ones of those would even be options to regulate AI? Not just AGI, but just AI itself.
Ostensibly, all of the laws on the books already apply to this sector. I think one of the challenges has been that a lot of the approach to regulation of the tech sector and its products has largely been structured where we're sort of like dealing with a lot of things after the fact. It's like playing whack-a-mole. You have to like surface a harm and then try and correct it, you know, figure out that like, yeah, that mortgage algorithm was disproportionately charging people in certain areas more than in other areas, or on the basis of different like protected characteristics, or you know that person was the victim of a deepfake scam. So you're trying to correct things and sort of like slaps on the wrist afterwards, instead of like having sufficient friction that puts the onus back on the companies to just make sure that their products are compliant with the law. That's been the real challenge, is like, how do you move all of that upstream? Because most other sectors we don't sort of deal with in this way.
Yeah, I think that's, I mean, I'm thinking about seatbelts, right? Like, we know that we need to put these guardrails on before there are problems. And
right, and a lot of the consequences are like kind of, they are life and death. Like, there are a lot of harms that can't be remedied.
Yes. So, right. Charlie, how are you using AI in writing? And how are you mentally, or are you intentionally not using AI? Do you have any concerns about writing skill regressions culturally because of AI usage?
I'll also say it took a long time to put those seatbelts in, right?
I was realizing that after I said that.
I was
hoping nobody was going to catch it. I was like,
it's not
like that happened.
How do I use it in writing? Oh, boy. Not a lot, I'll tell you that. I have my relationship as a writer to it, I struggle with it, right? Because it's like, that's the one thing I'm good at, and like, I don't want the machine to do it for me necessarily. There's so many different ways that people can try to use these tools, and I try to use them to understand them, and also if there are ways that they can help, they're really helpful. I tried to use them to, I use ChatGPT to, like, I don't know how to code, like, to help build me like a website, you know, from scratch that I was like, and I actually was like, you're my friend now. And I had to shut the computer because that was too much.
Was that recent or is that like
Yeah,
it
was like
ago?
6 months ago. I was okay. Like, wow. It was like walking me through and I like screwed up. It was like, buddy, you got this. Try it this way. And I was like, thanks, friend. And then I was like, oh no, it's happening.
Oh no, I'm liking
it's
it.
Happening.
No.
But honestly, I think I see it as, in my line of work, it's really scary to have a research assistant who is super aggressive and gets stuff wrong all the time, right? Like, it's just not all that helpful, and I do think that the process, a lot of times for me, of research, it's where I like I it's not where I like learn the facts necessarily. It's how I like change the way that I try to think about things, and like, that is where like a lot of the growing and a lot of like the getting better at the craft of what I do. So I really think that using it in those ways is it's not helpful to me. I do know a lot of journalists who use it not to write their stuff, but like as a idea sparring partner, or hey, I put this, give me like, you know, debate these points, right? Mm-hmm. Like toughen my argument, sharpen my argument. In terms of the writing skills, broadly speaking, like I have a pretty genuine concern. Maybe less about the writing skills per se, but like just the general, like the craft of reading and writing, and that, like, yeah. As someone who creates text for a living for people to read, and seeing the primacy of like short form video, not that there's anything like terribly wrong with that necessarily. I do think that like reading and writing are these like really fundamental building blocks of our cognition and help us understand how to reason, how to argue, how to think. And I do think that there is some devaluing of that when it becomes so easy to generate these other things. And I do think that there's some concern there. But I also do think that like the tools are really good at producing written text outputs. It's also boring as hell, like truly. Like, it's like, so often you can really tell the difference between writing that has that process of like that spark, whatever happens between the idea in your head and the thing that shows up on the page is our humanity. It's like our soul, right? And I think that like that is like, you really do feel that on a page. And I know that it's like ineffable. And when I tell this to people in Silicon Valley, they like, make motions that I won't say here and roll their eyes, but I just do think that there's something there, and I do think that that spirit will actually take a long time to fade out.
John, I think that question could get extended to higher education institutions. What do you observe, and how is higher education dealing with this?
At the moment, not well, but they're working on it. And I think that's the good news. I think they recognize that these tools are here, and they're not going to go away. And so there's a lot of focus being put on how do we use them actually to promote learning rather than to hinder learning. And we're still trying to figure out how to do that well. I don't think we have the answer yet, but they are working on it. One of the other things that is going on also has to do with how AI is being used or not in the context of doing research in academia. And it's kind of interesting because I find myself in a rather awkward position because I don't use AI to do research. I do research in AI. And a lot of people who are interested in that question forget that part. They only care about how do you support research using AI. And so, you know, when we were talking earlier today, this question of what I think you asked what was our favorite tool, and I said I don't have one. Because it comes down to doing research in AI, I look at AI tools and methods and algorithms as being components mm-hmm. that can be built upon, hopefully, to then build something better. I don't rely on the tool to help me do the research. I rely on the tool to be a component within my research. And that's it's actually a radically different perspective than the way others who talk about using AI tools, whether it's in education or research, approach that question. And I think for that, it's still very much an open question. And I think not only is it a question of how do we do it effectively, but how do we do it ethically? And that even goes back to the question about how do we discern true and false? What are the proper uses for these tools? How do we detect when they're not being used appropriately? And then how do we help guide the students or the researchers to make better use rather than the inappropriate use of the tools?
Does that include synthetic data as well?
So it really depends on what you mean by synthetic data. And from my perspective, a lot depends on the target problem. I see synthetic data not being used in isolation. I see it being used as a way of augmenting the real data that we are able to collect, hopefully as a way to potentially fill in gaps mm-hmm. and make the tools and the models that we're building more robust. If all you're going to do is work off of synthetic data itself, I think there is a potential for misuse there.
Next question, I think, is to you, Sarah. Can you talk about Palantir, the new immigration OS, and how we might discuss how the AI tools are driving policy? Nice light one for you there.
Sure. We talked a little bit about commercial surveillance. I think one of the things that we have seen over time, and this is not really like a super recent phenomenon, is increasing levels of the like collection of data in companies that can then be accessed by government agencies ostensibly through legal processes. The new phenomenon that we've started to see within a lot of different government agencies in the United States, in the UK, and elsewhere, is the contracting out with commercial firms to help them process and make sense of data and use that data. And Palantir is one of the firms that is really, really homed in on that. So how do they sort of go in and help structure, both through like bringing in business teams, but then also through like the production of data tools. One of the really, I think, for me, very worrisome phenomena that has happened in the last year or so has been that, you know, a lot of that movement has happened within particular agencies or within particular departments, but increasingly trying to integrate all of that data into structured, seamless data sets. So collecting IRS data, Social Security data. Even there was some reporting out of 404 Media about a company called Flock that has been selling automated license plate reader tools to local police departments in cities all over the United States, but that immigration authorities were able to get access to all of that local data, not through going to each individual police department, but through this company, Flock, became like a single streamlined source of lots of data on where people's cars are. And then you match that with immigration databases and you have a pretty good map of where, you know, where you're able to find people out in the world. So it's this like move from lots of data collection to making that streamlined and more easily accessible through like a single interface. And then this wrinkle of like, data's messy. Data is a representation, it's not like sort of a naturally occurring phenomenon, it's a representation of the world around us, you know, whether that's through like social processes or sensors, like these things fail. Data is often wrong, and we don't have access to what's in the data set, access to remedy where things are wrong, and so you're seeing these cases being reported out in the news where data that was sort of like collected in a giant database, like Immigration OS, containing erroneous information that was then used to bring people in. But because our immigration system is already fairly opaque, case files can be hundreds of pages long, you just can't get to like the original source of error in a way that like gives people meaningful due process. I think that loss of due process is one of the most pressing issues in front of us right now.
I had not thought of AI processes as a loss of due process. That's interesting and terrifying. What policies or legislature is in place to protect against privacy violations, propaganda, and misinformation? What legislation is not in place? Are there bills that we should be paying attention to?
We still don't have a federal data privacy law in the United States. That's one. There have been efforts to sort of bring something forward, thus far not successful. We do have, on the propaganda misinformation side, there are consumer protection laws that sort of address fraud, scams, deception, like that sort of whole category of uses of AI would be covered by consumer protection law under the previous administration. Chair Lina Khan sort of said very clearly many times over, there's no AI exception to the laws on the books. And so those are age-old statutes, still highly relevant today. At the state level, there's been a bunch of different laws passed that address deepfakes. And I think a lot of movement in, this is one area where I think that there's a lot of movement in Congress and elsewhere.
Can I extend that to international policy as well and the idea that we're in an arms race? How does that affect policy?
Yeah, I mean, so this idea that nation states are in a competition with one another to sort of be at the forefront of competition in AI, the idea has been around for a little while. We actually, at my institute, AI Now, we did a tracker that was looking at the arms race discourse going back to like at least 2017. It tended to sort of like crest at moments when regulation was about to be passed. So like, you're about to consider this antitrust package of bills. Well, here's all of these DOD officials that, you know, are all saying if you pass those antitrust laws, you're going to be holding back U.S. firms' prowess. So it's not to completely dismiss the idea that there is like this geopolitical competition around AI, but it is to say that this is something that also gets wielded to try and avert regulation. It's very much back in full stream now, both to try and hold off any effort to regulate the industry and also to really motivate like the state really rolling out the red carpet for AI firms.
Charlie, this next question is, I think it starts with you, but I think it might be relevant for others as well. Do you think there's a possibility that the global culture will eventually reject AI's replacement of humans and human productivity goals?
It's really interesting to think about, right? What I think about, something I was having a conversation with someone with a couple days ago was around this idea of the geopolitical race and this potential idea that it's just like it's not a thing yet, but this like theoretical notion that if there is like a bubble burst or there's an economic issue with the industry, like could the industry be too big to fail? Could it be backstopped by, you know, the United States government, especially a United States government that believes it's a national security imperative to win the AI race, right? And it is interesting to think about the sort of the cultural the backlash to some of the stuff that's happened with Silicon Valley and big tech firms, the general feeling. I don't know a lot of people who are really enjoying being on the internet like lately, you know. I think there's generally a feeling of whoever you are, whoever, whatever your media literacy, whatever your political party, whatever, this idea of constantly being manipulated, right? This idea of it feeling like you are constantly like walking through a market and someone's like, there's a phone case that you looked at 8 months ago, like buy it, you know, like whatever. Or being constantly fed things that try to turn you into the worst version of yourself or see the worst version of your neighbor, right? And respond in a way to be constantly shocked, outraged. Like there's a lot of animosity like in like populist rage towards some of these technology companies and the you know the billionaires that they mint, et cetera, you know, Elon Musk becoming a quote unquote trillionaire, things like that. And there's this idea that if we build this technology and it doesn't come to fruition and there's this like investment cycle that is really irrational and full of FOMO and full of these, you know, these deals that are circular and confusing and financialized and the thing kind of comes crashing down and retail investors and regular people are hurt by it and it gets bailed out by the government of this national security imperative. Like there's a really interesting cultural like thing to think about there, like a backlash. I mean, there's, if you look at the fallout from the financial crisis, I mean, there's a lot of ways that has shaped some of the political divides that we are dealing with today, right? Like these things are it's real like civic trauma, right? That we go through when these things happen. And so the idea that, you know, I don't know where it goes, but I don't think you can count out the notion of people feeling like they've been screwed with, that they're losing their agency in so many different ways, but also in like the actual way of like, it took my job, you know? So I think it's, you know, this, it's all super speculative, but that really kind of like stopped me in my tracks the other day when I was thinking about it and this notion of if there is at some point ever, you know, a bailout type thing that could really cause some, some genuine backlash.
I want to give you all a last question here, which is, what is the question that keeps you up at night about AI, and what is today's answer to that question? Each of you get 3 minutes to talk about that. John, do you mind if I start with you?
Sure. And believe it or not, the question is that your question is a relatively easy one for me. And it's one we've kind of skirted around, lightly touched on, but never really hit head on. How do we deal with the hype? And believe me, there is a lot of hype about AI right now. There's a lot of belief that these tools can do way more than they really can. And there's even this belief that things like ChatGPT, the LLMs, are capable of reasoning. They are not. There is no reasoning there. It is all just a great big probability distribution. And what is happening is that there is this societal view that has emerged about the power of AI. And by the way, I always go back and say, well, when you say AI, what do you mean? Because AI is way more than just LLMs and just chatbots. And unfortunately, the hype around them is misdirecting us as well. It's drawing our attention away from many other more promising areas in AI that are, as a result, not getting the funding they need to continue to develop. And that is concerning. And so one of the things that I attempt to do, and it's why I'm glad I get to kind of end my night on the note, is try to work to dispel the hype and to bring people back down to earth and realize that these are just tools built on data with no internal reasoning going on. There's no introspection. There is, and I hesitate to use this word because it's a loaded word, there's no soul. And I think we often forget that point. And so we need to remember that this is just basically a mathematical and mechanical artifact of what humans have created and put it back into that context.
Thank you. Charlie?
Question that keeps me up at night is, on this topic, is...
Now all of us want to know
what... Not a lot of...
What really keeps you up at night.
There's a lot of topics. There's a lot of stuff going on in the world. There's supposed to be like a really big earthquake in the Pacific Northwest. It keeps me up almost every night, okay? That's where I live. I'd say it's... Are there adults in the room? Is my question. And that is, I think, is like at the heart of this question about the economic bubble, right? Like it's the notion of like, are there people here? And by are there adults in the room, that you could also sort of take that to mean like, is there anyone thinking in the long term here? And that is really the, like, I don't know how to answer that in a way that would make anyone feel comfortable, because it doesn't seem that way, right? I was doing an interview about this, the AI bubble stuff, and bungling some of those stats that I bungled to you guys too tonight. And I was explaining some of it, and the interviewer said, "Are you sure you're correct? Because the more you explain it, the more it doesn't sound like it makes sense." And I was like, "That's why I was reporting on it, because I was actually like hoping that I would report this, write it, and a bunch of people would be like, here's a laundry list of everything you got wrong. Like, you are in so over your head." And it's not to say that I'm not. But also, a lot of people were like, yeah, that's kind of how it looks right now. And that leads to this question of, like, are there adults in the room with a long-term strategy on this, right? It feels this whole... The sort of the lesson that I have learned from covering Silicon Valley for a really long time, not a really long time, I don't know, like 17 years, is that there is so often this narrowing of the timeline, like aperture, right? It is just very focused on this obsession with scale. It's very focused on this obsession with extraction, right? Extraction of our data, extraction of, you know, whatever resources it needs in the moment. And there's this way in which you're like, you know, you're just like fracking everything and poisoning the well for the long term, right? And that's very concerning. And whether it's the economic stuff, whether it's the, are we just polluting our information ecosystem with slop? Is it, you know, are we, I don't know, you can compare it to anything that we've talked about tonight. It's like, how long is the timeline? Like, where are people thinking? Or are they thinking about the value of right now? Are they thinking about missing out? Are they thinking about beating China? Are they thinking about whatever? And we need people in the room, because there are uses for this technology, and we're not going to put it back in the bottle. Are there people who are thinking about this in the long term? So that's mine.
I mean, the question about are there adults, I think, is important, but the real question is there a room?
It's called cyberspace.
Sarah, your turn.
Not to get cheesy here, but genuinely, the question that I'm spending more and more and more time thinking about is like, okay, so what is the world that we actually do want to live in here? We've heard a lot of like critique on the stage today, and like, I come from the position that like being critical is actually like a fundamentally optimistic thing because you believe that the world can be better than where it is right now. But also, these aren't the only muscles to be using, and I'm feeling like the itch to like be building new muscles right now and to be able to put a clearer point on like what is the world that I want to be living in and like how do we get there, because I got into this like whole world because of like belief in human ingenuity and the belief that like we can build like really interesting and cool things, and technology as a part of that but not all of it. And right now it's been like the only thing to do is just be like, this is going in the wrong direction here. But I think it is also time to like reintroduce, okay, like this is the course correction that we're going to be needing as a society to like get us on a path that is going to be meaningfully additive to all of our lives. And I want to spend like all of my time in that headspace from here on out.
I like that. Thank you. Thank you all for coming, and thank you for answering all these questions. There were a lot more that were really good that we didn't get to. Janae, is there anything else? All right, you're free to go. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You have just heard the Bozeman Library Friends and Foundation's 10th symposium titled, The Future of Intelligence, Are We Ready for AGI? The speakers were Sarah Myers West, co-director of AI Now, John Shepard, distinguished professor of computer science at Montana State University, and Charlie Warzel, staff writer at The Atlantic. The panel was moderated by Tim Locke, founder of The Human Stack. They spoke before a capacity crowd at the Hager Auditorium of the Museum of the Rockies on the evening of November 12, 2025. Gallatin Valley Community Radio KGVM Bozeman was there to record it, and we are grateful to the Foundation's Executive Director, Janae Johnson, for production assistance in obtaining the permission to record this event. This has been a Beyond the Deep End production, recorded and produced by Joy LeClaire for broadcast and archiving on KGVM-FM and KGVM.org. Gallatin Valley Community Radio, KGVM, depends entirely on the financial support of our listeners to continue bringing you quality programming of, by, and for our community. We are grateful to those listeners, businesses, and organizations who do support KGVM. However, we really, truly do need more of you to join them by going to kgvm.org and click on the gold support KGVM button at the top of the page. We thank you for listening and for your support.